And my name is Stephen Nestor, welcome to Poets of the Tabloid Murder. Today we have with us Mark Coggins, author of The Immortal Game. Mark, how you doing?
Very good.
Mark, just do you have anything to tell us? Real briefly, what's new besides the publication of your first book?
What a great setup. Well, I was pleased to find out today that I was nominated for the Best First Novel Seamus Award.
And congratulations on that.
Thank you.
I have to say, I haven't, before you tell us a little bit about your book, I have to say I haven't seen a halfway decent literary edible red herring in a long time, but you provided us one in the Immortal Game. Why don't you just give us a brief plot outline of the book?
Sure. Well, thank you for the compliment, by the way. The book is set in Silicon Valley and the San Francisco Bay Area, and it revolves around the theft of some software. An entrepreneur named Edwin Bishop has developed a game to play chess. And he claims that the game is the best software that's been developed for a small computer to play the game of chess against humans. And his software is stolen by one of his employees, and he hires August Reardon, who is a private detective, to recover the software for him. And that kind of starts the thread of the adventure. The book is a good mix, I think, of sort of high-tech with a Silicon Valley flavor, of course, with the software and all that, with sort of a more traditional private eye setting and genre with the San Francisco setting and a lot of echoes, hopefully, of writers like Dashiell Hammett.
Yeah, I caught a couple of references to Hammett and Chandler, and something your offhand way with a real snide cutting remark reminded me of Raymond Chandler, which I really liked. You know, I don't want to compare you to him too often or say that's the only good thing about the book. I really enjoyed the book, but that was you had a nice touch with that, with the offhand, you know, punch in the face.
Well, thank you. I certainly, you know, I'd be the first to admit that I'm a big fan of Chandler's, and I certainly worked hard to establish a style that's frankly similar to his. And of course, what that involves is a lot of similes and comparisons,
yeah,
and dialogue.
Yeah.
But there were also just a few little sort of inside jokes for readers who are familiar with Hammett and Chandler in the book.
You want to give us a couple?
Yeah, sure. For instance, Reardon works in a building in San Francisco that used to house the Pinkerton Detective Agency in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Hammett worked for the detective agency,
right,
at that time. Another thing is Reardon has a sort of a ritual of tapping a clock on Market Street as he comes out of his office. And
mm-hmm.
That is actually a clock for an old jewelry company called Samuel's Jewelers. And in the 20s, Hammett actually worked there writing copy for advertising. So that's part of the motivation for that.
Gee, even I didn't know that. I try to keep up on my...
There's a couple little...
delving.
There's a couple little inside jokes as far as Chandler goes, too. One is just right on the dust jacket. I say that I live in San Francisco with my cat, Tacky, and in fact, I don't really have a cat, Tacky, but Chandler did, so it was a little joke for people in the know.
Well, also, Chandler was always playing chess games with himself. He'd set up a famous problem, and he'd try and figure it out. And
exactly right. Yeah, and that was one of the big motivations for choosing chess as a theme was Marlowe's habit of going home,
yep,
to his apartment and playing chess problems.
And tell us, what is the Immortal Game?
That is a reference to a famous game in chess history. It occurred in the 1800s. It's between two actual amateur players. And historians of chess have dubbed that particular match the Immortal Game because of the excellent play of the participants.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out, actually, that game has been a motivation for a number of literary works, including... there's a reference to it, and I didn't realize this until I started to write the book, to it in Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember,
yeah,
Terrell is playing chess against his employee, and they're going back and forth, and it turns out the moves they're actually playing in that chess game are from the Immortal Game.
Was that in the book that Philip Dick wrote, that chess? Was that part of the book as well?
Pardon?
was that part of the book, the chess game? That
was... Yeah, it was. But it's just been a source of a lot of interesting inspiration for literary efforts, including there's a short story called The Immortal Game. I didn't realize this until later, a science fiction short story. So there's been a lot of interest in that particular match.
It's a proud heritage.
There you go.
That brings us your book, The Immortal Game. And tell us, thank you for not delving too much into chess. I mean, I'm not much of a chess player. I play with my son, and I play with my computer, but if you really got into it, I'd be a little overwhelmed. So you keep chess to a minimum, which for me is good. For chess fans, I think they might be disappointed. Now, you're a Silicon Valley kind of guy. You're in the software business. What made you begin to write, number one, and what prompted you to write a mystery?
Well, it's an interesting story, I think. I actually went to school out here, and I was taking some creative writing classes undergrad. I didn't necessarily have a deep interest in it, but I decided I'd go ahead and do a little experimentation. And I was taking a class from a writer who at the time was a fairly young guy and just starting out. I think at that point he'd had one short story published. Mm-hmm. And he was a very good teacher, though. He's making a point that different writers have different sorts of styles, and he was reading different passages, and he happened to pick a passage from Chandler. In fact, he picked a passage from the beginning of The Big Sleep to make his point about Chandler's style. And I was so captivated by that I went out and gobbled up all of Chandler's books and read through them and got very excited by what I'd read and wanted to really try to emulate that. The kicker to the story, at least that part of it, is that this writer was Tobias Wolff, who, of course, is a famous author and a very well-respected literary writer. At that point, he really wasn't that well-known, but he became much better-known after that. I then actually started writing in that hard-boiled style, and I wrote a short story for another class at Stanford, which eventually got published in a publication called The New Black Mask, which was a quarterly collection, I guess, of the best in hard-boiled fiction is the way they build it. So the nice thing about that is, of course, the Black Mask was the place that Chandler and Hammett got their start originally, so it was kind of fun to get my first story published in a revival of that magazine it was in the 1980s when that was published, actually.
You know, for your background in computing, let me just preface this by saying that most writers try to write what they know about, especially when it comes to something technical that they incorporate in their book, and I was surprised to see that there wasn't really much in the way of computers or software or the business in your book. Just the plot revolves around the computer software business, but there's nothing really technical about that. I mean, did you ever think that you could have gotten yourself a whole another readership besides noir fans? You know, the computer geeks of the world could have rallied behind your book if you had just, made things interesting for them. And how come you didn't pursue that angle?
Well, that's a good question. There are a lot of different themes in the book, and of course, computers are there. But you're right. I didn't really delve into it as much as I might have, and nor did I delve into chess as much as I might have. I think what interested me about computers as a theme was just the Silicon Valley setting, and not so much trying to make it completely something that only people who were familiar with the technology would enjoy and understand. Even the small amount of technology that's in there, I worked hard to make understandable and approachable.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I found with early readers I had to rewrite sections because people, and for instance, had a lot of difficulty understanding exactly what source code is. Software is what you run on your computer, but what is source code and how does it become the programs that you run on your computer? And that was confusing to a lot of people.
Yeah, I thought if you decompiled a program, you'd be able to get the source code, but we won't get too technical.
Right. No, that is a point that's discussed in the book. But,
We're speaking with Mark Coggins, author of The Immortal Game, which is published by Poltroon. And tell us, how did this book what was your odyssey from typewriter to publishing house? How did that go, and what did you encounter along the way, and what did you learn?
Well, as Stephen, I'm sure you know, it's a different market out there right now than it used to be for authors in terms of getting first books in particular published. It's a lot harder for you to get picked up by a big house. Mm-hmm. I started out the traditional way that you hear most authors get started. I wrote the manuscript, and then I started looking for an agent, and I was fortunate to find one who was very enthusiastic about the book. And then she started shopping the book with the big houses in New York, and what we got back was a very consistent sort of message in the letters we'd get back. Love the book. We would have published this 5 years ago, but it's just not something we can really take a risk on right now. As I'm sure you know, with the consolidation of the bookstores into the big chains, publishing houses have fewer and fewer degrees of freedom to publish new authors that they can't be insured will be immediately bestsellers. So
what a shame.
It makes it very hard to break in. So eventually I started talking to some of the smaller presses. Poltroon is an interesting case. They're really not a mystery house at all. In fact, Alistair Johnson, who's one of the partners there, is known mainly for publishing poetry, avant-garde fiction. He's published some beat writers, for instance. But what he's really known for is he's done a lot of small editions of letterpress books, handset letterpress books. So I was actually very happy that he decided to publish the book because he is such a good designer and has such a love of books and publishing that, you know, I think one of the things that's very nice about the book is the way it looks and the way it's designed.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about that in a sec, because this is not your father's kind of book. But I just lost my train of thought. I'm too busy being fun here. What's the publisher's take on that, and what's your take? I mean, this must be kind of a golden age for small presses. I mean, because they probably are getting so much more material than they ever got before because of the consolidation of the large book publishers, and you know the quality of it must obviously it's great. I mean, because here's your book in front of me, and it's an excellent book. I mean, does that idea make sense, or what's your
take
on that?
Well, I think you're right. There's absolutely a trend towards smaller press, particularly in mystery. You see a lot of smaller presses springing up. Paradoxically, there's also perhaps in terms of the quality, there's certainly a lot more material available to a small press, but of course they don't have the resources of a larger press. So some of the small press editions you see that come out aren't edited very well, haven't got the design wherewithal to really put together a handsome volume. So it's good and bad news, I think. It would be nice if we were back, before, where there was lots of presses of medium size that did have the resources to do the very best for every book that they published. But given the environment, I can't help but applaud the fact that there are a lot of small presses who are willing to take on new authors. It's just too bad that they're not getting, all the financial support they really need to be effective in putting out the very best quality stuff.
Well, this is certainly a handsome volume. I would definitely put that in the handsome volume category. But one thing that separates your book from most of the ones out there is that there's photography in the book there's a picture a different picture which begins each chapter. Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
You are a photographer, and tell us about that. Tell us about the pictures and why you put them in, and what kind of did the publisher like the idea, or did you just figure out, for crying out loud, this is going to cost me, you know?
No, that's a good question. It was actually Alistair's idea, although he knew I was or am a large format photographer. If you're familiar with a couple of volumes that have come out of Chandler and Hammett's work that are illustrated, we had sort of been inspired by them. There's one of The Big Sleep with pictures of actors who are sort of playing the roles of the characters, which I didn't think was quite as effective as another one, which was The Maltese Falcon, which was done with period pictures of San Francisco. So Alistair has done a number of books where he has incorporated photographs. He's well known for doing designs of photography books, actually. So we were kicking around the idea for incorporating photographs in the book, and he really encouraged me to do that. I have a background in large format photography, mm-hmm. and actually take pictures on a semi-professional basis. And so I went around and used my large camera, which was kind of perhaps not the best tool for this purpose, but took what I hoped would be scene-setting pictures for each of the chapters. And we had a number of options for each chapter, and then looked through them and then picked out the best ones we thought that would set the stage for each chapter.
Mm-hmm. I'm not losing you, am I?
No, I'm sorry. I have to apologize to your listeners. I have a bad cold, so I'm losing my voice a little bit.
Yeah, it's allergy season up here. I know each picture is going to... you're coughing.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. I had a guest once who started reading from his work, and he coughed. He started coughing for 5 minutes. So nothing can top that. I like the each picture sets up the chapter, but one of the most helpful pictures I found was it's a picture of a page from a dictionary, and we're in the P's. I'm talking about. Are you back with me now?
Yeah, I'm with you. I've just been covering the microphone while I cough.
it's a page from a dictionary. We're on a page with P's, words
right.
with letter P. There's a magnifying glass on top of the page so we can see better, and you give us the definition of the word patzer.
Right, right. That's a term, of course, that refers to a poor or unprofessional chess player. And there's a couple interesting things about that shot. That shot was actually very hard to do, to get the lighting just right so that you didn't have a lot of reflection off the magnifying glass was a real challenge, actually. So that's one I'm kind of proud of. Most people looking at it probably wouldn't realize how difficult it is to do that well.
And we thank you for it.
But there's a reference in the book to Patzer, and I don't think I'd be giving much away if I say that the Reardon's employer gets pretty upset with him at one point in time and refers to him that way.
Yeah, that makes sense. We're going to have a cough break here on Poets and Tabloid Murder.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. I think you need a slug of bourbon like your protagonist seems to consume with an alarming...
I'm trying.
lost my train of thought again. What am I going to do? What are you working on now? You've got this book, and congratulations on the Seamus nomination. I mean, this book's going to be worth a lot of money. It probably is worth a lot more than the $20-something it costs.
Well, it has been very popular with collectors, as you're suggesting.
Yeah.
And in fact, I've seen it on the Internet for sale for more than list price right now. And I think it's partly because it is a handsome volume. It's partly because it was a relatively small run from a small press. And, of course, being a first-time author, first novels are usually the most collectible, assuming the author goes on to be successful later. So it has been popular,
plus,
I think, with collectors for that reason.
Yeah, plus I have a signed copy. What's it going for on the Internet?
I don't know. You can see what people ask for and know whether they're getting those prices. I've seen it up to 45 for a signed copy.
Well, I'm pulling for you and that Seamus war. That's when it's a real payday for Steve Nestor.
There you go.
Okay, where were we? I'm having a heck of a day here myself.
Sorry, I'm my cough, I'm sure, is distracting you. You did ask me about what I was doing now in terms of a next book.
Uh-huh.
I'm working on a new Reardon novel, and the working title is Vulture Capital. And it's a little bit more deeply steeped in the Silicon Valley, and in particular, as the name suggests, it's about a little bit more about venture capital and that whole industry. Reardon is hired by a venture capitalist to help locate a missing chief technical officer for a startup company. So a little bit more about venture capital, which I think people will find interesting. There's also some Napa Valley wine lore in the book. There's several characters who own wineries, and we get an opportunity to go up there and learn more about that, too.
Well, I guess you can't drive to Napa Valley without bumping into a vintner someplace.
Yeah. Exactly.
And how far are you into this book? Is it complete?
Well, I have a first draft done, and I think it's a good first draft, but it does definitely need some more rewriting and work. So I'm in the midst of doing the rewrites now.
Will it be published by Poltroon?
It may well be. One possibility is to go with them for a short run. As you often see some of the authors do, they get a short run of a, you know, a collector's edition of a book, and then do a larger edition with a bigger house. So I might do that with Poltroon, have a short run, or, or maybe just do a larger run with him as well.
Yeah, let him cash in a little bit. Like Dennis McMillan does that kind of thing. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, yes, no, exactly. He does that with Crumley a lot, I've noticed.
Yeah, he's good. He seemed to be a the kind of place you could find a book like yours, that type of publishing house right there. But you know, you're a very busy guy. I mean, you still work full time like most writers, unfortunately, have to. You write the book, you do the photography. I mean, what is your I mean, do you sleep? What's your preferred activity here?
Well, it is that is a good question. I tend to go in phases. I did the writing for both books first, of course, and then came. Boy, excuse me, Stephen. I'm really having trouble here.
All right.
Let me take another slug of not bourbon but water.
Go ahead, slug away. I'm going to read. Will you take a slug of water? A couple of paragraphs from this book, okay? This is one that I just love this one. So, put your hand over the phone and start coughing. This is on page 142. You're describing the femme fatale, and she's meeting Reardon. Okay, let's see. Where do we go? Blah, 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 blah. Standing less than a foot away, I caught the faint scent of her perfume. It was like breathing rarefied air at high altitude. "I'm sure I'd like to tell you," I said, "but I respond better to the carrot than the stick." A smile tugged at the corners of her mouth. "Sure, Reardon, I understand. I bleep you, and then you tell me everything you know. Well, here's a little down payment to loosen you up." She reached her fingers behind the back of my neck and pulled my head to hers. Cushioning her lips against mine, she probed my mouth with a hot tongue that darted around like an agitated tropical fish. That's Chandler right there. Her mouth tasted of fire and liquor. Chandler again. She stepped back when she was done and looked up at me with a kittenish expression. Then she slapped my face.
I'm glad you picked that passage. I kind of had fun with that, and it is intended to be kind of a homage to Chandler in the way that he would write a scene like that.
Yeah, so. The cadence of the sentences is perfect, and this the setup for the bringing you up and bringing you down is perfect. Bravo!
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Bravo! I say. So, besides Chandler, I mean, who do you look to as a writer that not someone to emulate, but someone who does the job well, and someone who could be kind of almost like a blueprint as who does it well?
Well, I have a lot of heroes in the mystery genre. I mentioned Crumley. I like him a lot. I like Estelman a lot. I like Pronsini a lot. And outside of mystery, writers who I admire who don't necessarily write mysteries but do kind of write hard-boiled or you know, a little bit tougher kind of genre, I very much like the book Deliverance. Everyone thinks of the movie, but if you've read the book, it's really a very good book. And that's James Dickey, of course.
Yeah.
Another book I like...
Yeah.
It's an interesting book because it's told first person, kind of like a Private Eye novel, very well written, is All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren, and I really admire that writer and that particular character that he created, and the whole narrative in that book is also inspirational to me.
Yeah, the book Deliverance blows the movie out of the water. Plus, you don't have to watch James Dickey ham it up as a Southern sheriff.
Right, as the sheriff,
he does do a good job, but he's like when he's in front of that camera, boy, he knows it.
Well, I guess there was a lot of tension between him and the director during the filming, too. So much so, I think he published what he thought was the way the screenplay should have been shot, or something like that.
Yeah. There's a brand new biography out about him. Maybe I'll go to a major chain store and sit on their chair and read it like everybody else does at these major chains. That's a whole new subculture, I think. People who, I mean, because it's like a bookstore, I guess, is one of the few places where you can take the product and consume it at the store without buying it, right?
That's very true. And then it's also a very rare thing that bookstores can return books back to the publisher if they don't sell them. So it's almost a consignment business. So it is kind of a funny business in a way.
So what's your take on the publishing business, Bob? I know we got down with it a little bit, but I mean, it's what the problem is with what's called the mid-level author. is being left in the wayside. Am I correct?
That's exactly right. Mid-level or mid-list author is definitely having a harder time now. And you know, you mentioned the small presses. That's one reaction to it. The other thing you see, of course, is the new e-books. A variety of means of publishing electronically now. The other thing that's coming out is print-on-demand, which is a way to print books just when you need them. And then finally, of course, you actually see with MP3, audiobooks as kind of an alternative way to distribute books electronically. And I think all of those things have a place. Like anyone who's sort of grown up with books in the traditional way, and even though I'm in the computer industry, I'm a little leery of some of these technologies and what they'll mean. Print-on-demand, you know, the danger there is that the quality isn't as good, and it certainly does kind of ruin the whole collector's aspect to the market. There's not really such a thing anymore as a first edition when you do it that way. Electronic books, they don't have the same feel. I'm a collector, by the way, in case you haven't figured it out. And, you know, you just don't have that same feel. It certainly does open a market up, though. And, like they said, you know, TV didn't destroy radio. I'm sure that we'll see all of these things coexisting. And the good news is they do let authors who wouldn't otherwise have a market have an easier time of breaking in, I think.
What would you have done if you... I mean, your book, there's no way your book was not going to get published. What would you have done if you weren't able to find a publisher? And obviously you believe in your book and a lot of other people did. Would you have resorted to just, you know, putting it on the internet?
I think my next step would have been to do some kind of self-published thing. You know, that's not an unusual route for authors. If you know the story about Scott Turow, actually self-published his first book and was selling it out of the back of his car for a long time to bookstores. That probably would have been my choice, just because I do like the idea of having a real volume and a real physical book that you can hold in your hands. But certainly e-publishing is another alternative, and it's one that I think is a good thing. I don't mean to come across as saying I don't think it's good, but it has some downside to it too, no question.
Yeah, I kind of like, well, call me old fashioned, but I just like the book in my hand, you know.
Exactly.
I mean, they all have their own smell. I mean, they're nice and you open it up, it's nice and tight, and the pages aren't smudged, and you're not staring at a screen, so it's a little bit easier on the eyes.
Yeah, but no, definitely. It's a better experience for the reader, I think.
It's a sensual experience, I think.
No, I was talking to a bookstore owner actually in Seattle recently on a signing, and he told me that he learned early on in the book business that when you're selling books, you don't point at a book to a customer, you actually hand them the book so that they can feel it, and it helps with the sale because there is a connection people make with a physical book.
So tell us, they have you, Paul Troon has you out flogging your product. What's
that
like?
I'm just about at the end of that cycle, actually. I did have a number of signings, primarily, frankly, on the West Coast, just because of the limited budget we have for this sort of thing. I was up in Seattle this last weekend, and I was at the Seattle Mystery Bookstore, and I think that's probably the last signing I'll have until I am going to, of course, go to BoucherCon, because that's the same time when the Seamus Awards will be, that's the banquet dinner in the same time frame. So, you know, hopefully I'll be available for signing books and things like that at that point.
Yeah, you're the man now.
that's nice of you to say. I don't quite think of myself that way. When you think of all the long struggle to get to this point, it's very gratifying, though, to be nominated this way, especially coming from a small press.
And what was this is going to, I guess this will really give small presses a real kick in the avoir du poids. There's only a certain type of person who pays attention to the small press, the diehard fan and the collector, and probably, the large publishers. I would imagine, because what would they? Has anyone approached Paul Troon and said, "Hey, look, you know, if this book is about to hit it, why don't you let's, you know, make the business transaction where we publish it?" You know, has anybody approached Paul Troon with that idea?
Well, there has been interest of from various sources, including a little bit from a few nibbles from Hollywood about the book. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, it's definitely gotten some more attention. To be honest, I'll tell you what, there was a couple of very kind acts that people did for me that helped me get the attention I did.
Yeah.
Lauren Estelman was very kind and gave me a very good jacket blurb.
Yeah.
The same with Tony Hillerman, and mm-hmm. it's unusual for a small press book to get those kinds of writers with willing to do blurbs. And then the other thing that really helped was the Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle,
uh-huh.
took a flyer on it and did a review that was very favorable for it, and that really got it attention and really launched it out there. So, you know, you just got to keep plugging and try all the avenues you can. And mm-hmm. if the work is good, then you will get attention eventually.
Yeah.
But it's just going to take a little bit longer in the market being the way it is.
Well, the book deserves all the attention. I really enjoyed reading it. I read many books a week. It just, you know, sometimes I don't make it through them all. So, you know, I have to figure out, you know, who I'm going to speak with, because I only do the show once a week. But this one really stood out. And it was, did you take the dust cover photo as well?
Yeah, I did. I took that one first, and I sort of visualized that, and then went from there to do the other ones. But I'm pretty pleased with the dust jacket. I've had a number of compliments on that.
Okay, we've got 30 seconds. So what book's on your nightstand right now?
Oh boy, I'm just finishing Nightmare Town, which is a collection of short stories from Hammett, and actually I got a book called The Complete Idiot's Guide to Chess.
Attaboy.
from the U.S. chess champion 2 years running who read my book and really liked it. So that was very gratifying. So I decided I'd get his book and brush up on my chess technique.
Yeah, that sounds like a good book for me. Mark, thank you for being on the show. We've been speaking with Mark Coggins, author of The Immortal Game, which is published by Poltroon. And let us know what you're up to. And when you get your new book out, we'll have you back on the show.
Great. Thank you very much, Stephen. I enjoyed it.
Okay, my name is Stephen Estrom, and you've been listening to Poets of the Tabloid Murder. Stay tuned for the Pacifica Network right here on WHUS.